You're listening to KZSC Santa Cruz, 88.1 FM, kzsc.org, broadcasting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is Transformation Highway. The San Francisco Mime Troupe is back again with Political Musical Theater in Tales of the Resistance, Volume 2, Persistence. Today you'll hear from their musical director, Daniel Savio. Due to the ongoing pandemic, the Mime Troupe is creating podcast radio plays instead of in-person performances, which are being released weekly from July 4th to September 5th. Themes include institutionalized racism, the destructive forces of capitalism, and the movement to shift community safety away from police. There are also special discussions scheduled with activists and artists on issues like police brutality and community safety, as well as podcasts that review key moments in revolutionary history, like the 1966 10-point program of the Black Panther Party. The artist behind the music and lyrics for this 62nd season of the Tony Award-winning San Francisco Mime Troupe is Daniel Savio, who lives in Richmond, California. Back in 1968, Daniel Savio's mother and father were protesting in Berkeley for freedom of speech and an end to the U.S. war on Vietnam. Mario Savio became a prominent activist. Once, he participated in a sit-in on top of a Berkeley University police car. Before that, Mario was helping African Americans register to vote in Mississippi during Freedom Summer in 1967. In 2004, San Francisco Gate reported that the FBI spied on Savio for years because he had emerged as the nation's most prominent student leader. Here's a short excerpt from Mario Savio's speech delivered at UC Berkeley's Sproul Hall on December 2, 1964.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Here now is Mario Savio's son, Daniel Savio, on the current season of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Daniel begins by talking about his time as a student here at the University of California at Santa Cruz, where he graduated in 2004 with a BA in music. Was your time in Santa Cruz significant in terms of what you later did with music, activism?
Maybe a little bit, but I think I was already on that path. That's how I ended up in Santa Cruz, was that I was already interested in those things.
How so? Tell me about that.
Well, my family background is in liberal politics. We called it liberal politics when I was growing up. Now I would probably call it progressive politics. And if I had understood more at the time, I would have called it progressive politics then too. I don't know. Are you aware of who my father is?
Yes. Yeah. And of course, I want to hear about how that's important to you and what seeped into you and through you, because that's a particular, really interesting position to grow up with. You know, tell me about your dad. I mean, that's, I looked, you know, to remind myself about him and these speeches he gave that, you know, there at Sproul Hall, and these things that really moved people that still move me. Put your bodies on the gear of the machine. My great heroes in this world, in this lifetime, are the people that have been willing to do that. And I think often of Kathy Kelly and the Catholic Worker people who are willing to go to Iraq during the sanctions against going there to deliver medicine and food. And the U.S. government says, you're going to go to prison. And they say, I'm going anyway. Or when I first moved to Santa Cruz in 1989, two friends of mine came down to Southern California to smash these GPS satellites that are the global positioning satellites for nuclear weapons. And they really thought, if 1,000 other people did this to the grand machine, we could stop war making. So tell me about your dad who stood up there and said, we need to put our bodies, you know, on the line here and stop the machine.
Well, so I was born in 1980. So, it was 16 years after free speech movement. So I grew up thinking of my father as somewhat of a heroic figure. And my mother as well, but she was not ever as much of a public figure, although she was also involved in free speech movement and participated really just as much, just not as publicly. So I grew up thinking of progressive politics as pretty normal and the standard by which I judged other politics. Ronald Reagan was an asshole, which was how I said as a little child. When I came to an age where political discussions began happening between me and my peers, I was sort of shocked that they weren't all already on my side. And the places that I was living, they were mostly on my side of center. Although still not all of them, but most of them. But things have changed. When I started college in Santa Cruz, I had a few friends who still spoke essentially, as we all do, parroting what their parents had said to them, as I do. But what their parents had said to them was how Ronald Reagan was the greatest president ever. By the end of college, they didn't think that anymore. So that gives you some indication of how political a place UC Santa Cruz was when I was there, which was, you know, not nearly so much as Berkeley in the 1960s, but still somewhat. And I think actually it's accelerated since then, that in the years since, people of my generation, or at least my cohort, have become more political and further to the left. You know, we haven't grown more conservative as we've gotten older. As we were told was going to happen. I think it wasn't just my dad. It was also my parents' friends, because most of my parents' friends were people that they had known since the 1960s and who had gone on marches with them together. So it wasn't just my parents. I was surrounded by a whole community of similar thinking and acting people.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You're listening to an interview with Daniel Savio, musical director for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Here again is Daniel Savio. You know, what jumps out at me is the title of this year's Mime Troupe season, the 60-second season, Tales of the Resistance, Volume 2, Persistence. So I have seen during my years of activism this interesting tension between accepting a long-term view. The revolution is going to take a while. And then the immediate desire to have things change now. And so this year's season is called Persistence, which I think combines those two things. You know, we have to be, it's best to be calm and grounded and to take direct action. If you want to say something about that, also I can add in, I went to UCSC in 91, 92, and I did community studies there. I'm a little disappointed that the revolution is not really happening, not as fast as I would have expected through this lifetime I've had. So tell me about being patient, taking direct action, and persistence.
In the 60s, they thought that they were having a revolution right then. And I think that was naive. Also, I'm not sure how I feel about revolutions in general. This is going to put me on the wrong side of a lot of my progressive friends. It's not that I think that incremental change is better, because I don't. But I think incremental change may be actually more effective in the long run. And, you know, there are probably people who know more about history than I do who might tell me, oh, no, you're wrong about that, and here's why. So, I don't want to say here, and I'm absolutely right about this, because I may not be. But, you know, sometimes in revolutions, the wrong people get hurt, right? Not to say that it's good for anybody to get hurt, but people who were already hurting get hurt. So hopefully we want to try to avoid that, but... You know, persistence, I think, is there's two sides of it. It's one, keep going, even though we don't know when or if we're going to win. And two, there are struggles that have tangible, real results that fall short of, like, ultimate victory, but are still worthwhile. And that, I think that comes on a lot of levels, that Black Lives Matter has had, I think, real tangible results. Not everything that is necessary or that is desired, but real tangible results. I think we're better off now because of the protests of Black Lives Matter and Occupy, but there's more still to be done. So persistence is keeping going in the face of we're not going to win everything, certainly not right now, and possibly not ever. I'm also reminded of, I want to say it's Martin Luther King, and it may not be. The arc of history is long and it bends towards justice. I'm not sure I agree with that. Because it bends towards justice is a little rosy, maybe, but it's a good way of thinking to keep yourself hopeful. So persistence is both, I think, inner and outer. It's having the strength to keep going yourself, but also it's us all together persisting in the struggle.
Yeah, I have come to question the idea of revolution for sure. And especially, I see it much differently than I did 30 years ago. It's just the ideas around power and, I guess, challenging the whole premise of power and control. And I like more Buddhist revolutionary theory or anarchist theory around, like, Joanna Macy has talked about how, you know, just taking over the power and promising to use it in a better way, but still dominating, that's like turning over the dung heap. You have a different part of the heap on top now, but it still has that premise of domination and control. So I tend to hope that human beings do have a natural tendency to move towards living peacefully. I don't necessarily see it happening. And during this last year, what a trip it's been during this pandemic and seeing people challenging broadly all the institutions of our lives, and especially around domination and control, policing, punishment, but also education and healthcare. Like people, I've never heard so many people around the world saying, we need to change all of these institutions.
Yeah, I think there's also the institutions that we have been built for two purposes. One is to improve the lot of the people who are in control and who have power, and to just to make their lives even better. And the other is to provide just enough services for everybody else that they stay in their place, right? It's not really to provide all the services that we need or would want. It's, you know, it's a little bit more of a carrot and a stick situation. So, you know, I'm a big Star Trek fan. I would love to have a future utopian society where, you know, people's needs are all met and that everybody has wonderful opportunities. There's a line to be straddled between unrealistic hope and tempered optimism, right? So I hope, but I'm not unrealistic, or I try not to be. But doing that can lead you to give up sometimes, right? You know, hope is kind of, it's important for giving us the strength to carry on. So that's part of persistence also, right? In some ways, things have gotten a lot worse since Mario was active in the 60s. And in some ways, they've gotten a lot better for a lot of people. And I think to deny either one of those is both unrealistic and also shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of our, not only in terms of logistically accomplishing the goals that we want to accomplish, but also in terms of our inner lives, our psychology, how we feel about the things that we do. Do I feel like I've wasted my life in trying to help people because I haven't been able to save the world? Well, no, I think it was worth it anyway. And especially, I think, for people, because a lot of what I do is the arts and not activism. There's some activism in there, but there's also lots of art stuff that I do that really has nothing to do with politics whatsoever, or only to the extent that all art has something to do with politics. For me, I think it's actually a little bit easy. It's like, yeah, working with Mindtrim is awesome because I feel like I'm helping people and I get to do art at the same time. For the people who are working directly with Democratic Socialists of America or BLM, I have to imagine that for them, it might be more difficult to feel like they're accomplishing something, but I really think they are. It's a longer struggle. It's a struggle that's been going on for centuries, literally for centuries, and isn't going to stop anytime soon. But that doesn't mean that the work isn't valuable and necessary. Mm-hmm. My peers who are more directly involved in activism, I, to some small extent, put them on a pedestal. I look up to people like that, and I don't really have the, I don't want to, not necessarily courage, but sort of the fortitude to make those struggles a more central part of my own work. It's daunting. That's a really daunting task to put, the entire survival and livelihood of our entire species on yourself. That's a lot. So the best I do is I try to help in my smaller way, I think.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You're listening to an interview with Daniel Savio, musical director for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Here again is Daniel Savio.
Hello.
Tell me about your relationship with the Mime Troupe. I think that you got connected with the troupe in 2006 and you write lyrics and you compose. Tell me about that relationship and about whatever stands out for you about this year's events with the Mime Troupe.
Sure, yeah. Well, so my cousin, Jeremy Mage, who is also a pianist and composer and songwriter, and who now lives in Switzerland with his wife and child. He was a keyboardist for the Mime Troupe before I was. I think maybe around the time you were in college, actually. And then in 06, they called him because they needed somebody and he wasn't available, and he put them in touch with me. So it's pure nepotism, originally. And so then I did a couple of seasons. The first in 06, I was just a sub for a couple of dates. And then in 07, I played piano for the entire season. And then I went away from the troupe for a while. I mean, I popped my head in every now and then to help with some off-season events. But I wasn't in the band again until 2015. And in the meantime, I had been doing just music, or music and musical theater. So it was a period of building my own skills, right? And then so I came back in 2015 to be in the band again, and I've been working with the troupe ever since. And in 2018, I think it was 2018, I was invited to join the collective, and so that makes it a very different thing. It's no longer just a gig. You're on the front lines. You're seeing how the sausage is made, which is a little bit scary, actually. It feels good to be part of a team doing what I consider really important work. And so let's see, until last year, I was just playing the piano. I mean, as we do when we're creating a new show, I would put in my suggestions, but I wasn't the composer. I wasn't the musical director. At some point, I think, what was it, Michael Bello, who had been our musical director, had to take some time off because he's got a new child. So last year, I took over duties as composer and lyricist. We had another person as musical director. And then this year, I'm doing all three. This year there are, I think, going to be probably fewer songs overall, because the Mime Troupe varies, right? I mean, some years we do like really a musical, and it is a musical, and there's lots of songs. And then other years you might do something that you might consider a play with music, and maybe there's just one or two songs in it. I think this year's show is going to be a little bit less musicalized than last year's was, but there will still be songs. It's really like the Mime Troupe is such, this isn't just the Mime Troupe, this is musical theater is so demanding on the artists involved. Every skill that they have could be called upon. I mean, if you're an actor, do you sing? Do you dance? Do you juggle? I mean, just about anything, right? And for somebody on the creative side, I write the music, I write the lyrics, I teach the actors how to sing the music and how to sing the lyrics. I help create what the musicians are actually going to play, although there's an interplay there where I rely very heavily on the musicians themselves to also know their instruments so well that they'll come up with stuff that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of. So it's a collaborative process. To some extent, that's a lot harder remotely, doing it over, you know, over the internet instead of all together in the studio. There are some things that are easier about it, but I think overall it's actually just a lot harder. It does present opportunities and suggest ideas that we might not have thought of otherwise. And it also, here I can give an example. When we're doing shows in the parks, we're limited to what we have there in the park and what we can reasonably bring with us. When we're doing recorded shows, well, the band right now consists of myself on keyboards, we've got a drummer, we've got a bassist, and we've got somebody who plays woodwinds. Let's say that I really, really need somebody playing trumpet in some future episode. We could hire a trumpet player for one episode that we wouldn't have been able to add a fifth band member for the entire season. So that's, you know, that's an opportunity. Similarly, so I mentioned my cousin. Last year, one of the songs, or a couple of the songs that we recorded, actually, I created with my cousin, who's in Switzerland, and there's no way I would have been able to do anything with him on that level if we were trying to do our live show. So it has presented some fun opportunities, definitely.
I was noticing that, firstly, some of the presentations are going to be more of like radio dramas, and I think that's what was done last year during this pandemic time as well. And there's a few parts of this year's Tales of the Resistance that...
The discussions
and the eyeball on history that talk about key moments in revolutionary history that are overlooked, like the Black Panthers. So tell me, is that something that grabs your attention in particular, that discussion? And maybe say something about having these discussions be part of the Mind Troop.
Yeah. Last year, we did do all of these things, but we did them a little bit differently. So last year, we did have some discussion events, but they weren't broadcast as part of the show. They were separate events. And so we're trying to sort of put the focus a little bit more on them. And bring more listeners to those events. And also the Mime Troupe, you know, obviously it's always been a dual purpose. There's entertainment and information. Actually, I should say a triple purpose, because it's entertainment, information, and a call to action to the extent we're allowed to do that on the radio. I know there are rules, so we have to be careful about how we construct our call to action. But there's, you know, it's... Hopefully it's not a direct call to action, but simply showing people the facts to the point where they just feel that they have to take action. And I think that's usually how we structure our stage shows as well. Try to show people the world as it is and give them little hints of how the world could be, so that hopefully they feel compelled. Trying to sort of centralize those discussions a little bit more. But, you know, some of these themes are, they keep coming up. I mean, I came back to the Mime Troupe in 2015. Well, the show in 2015 was Freedom Land, which was a show about police brutality, primarily against people of color. And that is a topic that didn't go away, obviously. Why would it? So we discussed that issue also in last year's show, and we're going to discuss it some in this year's show as well. Also, the structure of Tales of the Resistance itself is substantially different from our usual stage shows. Our stage shows are usually one story. We've created one story. We're telling you this story. For Tales of the Resistance, both last year and this year, there are several different storylines. And last year, they ultimately all came together in the final episode. All of our previous storylines all tied together. This year, it's a little bit different. We've got a couple of storylines that do end up coming together like that. And then we also have some one-offs. So like Eyeball on History, and I think we have something called Little Jimmy's Dilemma, which is also a continuation of some of the things we had last year. These are more kind of one-offs. The structure overall of Tales of the Resistance is a little bit what you call an anthology series. So, you know, all these different things all fall within Tales of the Resistance, even if they're not directly tied together through the storyline, but they're still tied together by subject matter and by the troops overall. What it is we do, and it's all there.
Yeah, it's obviously police violence, particularly against Black and brown people. It's not a new phenomenon. People are realizing actually policing was designed to do that. That's problematic for Americans. Of course, we were raised to believe that there are blemishes on the supreme democracy that was established in this country, and you can point to them and discuss them. What has happened the last 20 years and in this concentrated way the last year, this eyeball on history across the country and across the world. And you said earlier, you know, politics generally is designed to improve the lot who are in control. And lo and behold, you look at the actual documents of the people who created the United States of America, and they said, we want to be in charge, and we don't want women involved, and people who don't own property, and people with different skin color, and we're going to own some of you and sell some of you. And Wall Street was created to do that slave selling, and policing was created to help maintain that control.
Yeah, it's at the core. It's not just surface blemishes. It is at the core. And you know, again, talking about revolutions, is the only way forward to throw everything out and start over? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I mean, to some extent, looking at world history, the United States Constitution is pretty great in some ways. Is it perfect? Not even close. Not remotely close. Is it better than Hammurabi's Code? I think so. That's human history is incremental improvements. That's the history of our species. So to think that a document written over 200 years ago only by white landowning males would be the pinnacle of potential human political achievement would be seriously naive. I was naive enough about it as a child before I understood things like that anarchism and chaos are not the same thing. I have a better understanding about it now, but even as a child, I understood that American democracy, while cool, wasn't as cool as it could be. You need to be able to have conversations with people who do still think that America is the pinnacle of human achievement without chasing them off. And some people I'd decline to have such a conversation with, but there are people who maybe people who think of themselves as liberals, who I would like to convince to become progressives. I would have that conversation with them and would hope that I might be able to convince some of them. Mm-hmm. Trump voters, not so much. Not going to waste my energy. Mm-hmm. Someone else can do that.
I just saw my first Trump 2024 flag.
Oh gosh.
that's bad. That's
yeah.
It's a horror show.
I'm not really thinking that Trump 2024 is much of a likelihood. What I am a little bit more concerned about is Trump's children running for president in a future election once enough people have forgotten what happened. I mean, that's kind of what we got with the Bush family. Failing upward. I mean, it's a family of incompetent idiots somehow getting themselves to the highest levels of political achievement everywhere. It's not completely fair. Bush Sr. was not an incompetent idiot. He was just evil. Or bad, anyway. His kids are morons. I don't understand this family at all. I mean, you'd think they would be able to afford the best education, and yet somehow they're not. So it's a little bizarre to me. Mm-hmm. But I think there's definitely potential, and I mean even likelihood, really, that in the future Trump's children will try to resurrect the movement that their father started. And potentially with some success. That is more frightening to me, because I think Trump is himself too bad at what he's trying to do to be very successful at it now that it's been seen, right? I mean, he's good enough so that the first time he was able to win, and then so bad at actually doing the job that I don't really think there's any chance that he himself could be elected to the presidency again. It seems very, very unlikely. I probably shouldn't count my chickens, though, right?
I think it's unlikely, too. But I keep reminding myself that roughly half of this country voted for him. So when I'm thinking about, this last year, there's been a lot of changes in action and thinking. Maybe for, if we're lucky, half of America.
Well, our saving grace is that, as pathetic as this is, our saving grace is that the voters don't actually control that much in this country. And so it's actually less a question of how many people directly voted for him and more a question of whether people with a lot of money will support him again. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they will. Mm-hmm. Some will. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that a lot of the big corporations that gave him a lot of money the first time around would be less likely to do it the second time. Mm-hmm. Some of them still will. Hobby Lobby, Chick-fil-A, you know, places that they do not go.
Hey, do you live in San Francisco or Oakland? Or?
I live in Richmond, California, in a place called Atchison Village, which is a little communist utopia here in the Bay Area, sort of. Not exactly. Atchison Village was built in World War II to be dock workers' housing for the shipyards in Richmond. And then after the war, the government was going to tear the place down. And the people living here, got together and formed a corporation themselves and bought the entire division from the government. So it is a privately owned low-income housing development. And it is absolutely without a doubt the best real estate deal in the Bay Area by quite a wide margin, several orders of magnitude, I think. I'm probably using that phrase wrong. I'm not a mathematician, but by a lot, it's actually not such a bad place. There's families, there's retirees, there's white people, there's people of color. You're not too far from the, Point Richmond, which is a little bit more segregated and a little bit more bougie but has some nice restaurants and has a nice area to a park by the water where you can take walks right by the bay. So it's not such a bad place to live, in my opinion. The only thing that I do not like about it, and that everybody around here does not like about it, is the presence of the Chevron oil refinery. And it's not so much like, you know, every now and then there's like big noises or something. That doesn't bother me so much. I think like at 11 a.m. every Wednesday, they test the emergency system. They did it at 7. That would bug me. At 11, it's not so bad. What I don't like is that the air pollution from the refinery that has affected the local community, without a doubt. And I don't know to what extent it has affected me personally. I've only lived here about, 5 or 6 years, something like that. I can't remember. But I'm quite sure that people who have lived here much longer have absolutely been affected by it. Children with asthma, and that sort of thing, and more. So Chevron, not great. Other than that, Richmond is a pretty wonderful place, and a really, I think, actually a vibrant community that could use a little bit more institutional support from the state, hopefully, but is actually really a wonderful town.
I am so curious now because, and I wonder what you think about this. You know, 5 years ago, I went with my family to go see Hamilton in Los Angeles. My son is now 13. And at that time, we're listening to that CD in the car, and he knows all the words. The songs are very sharp. Lyrics are very nicely structured. Half the kids I knew were memorizing these lyrics. We went and saw this, and it's a great production. And I'm very uncomfortable thinking I'm not hearing the critical voice about this history of slavery. These guys, you know, that's kind of fun to be able to sing and dance about slaveholding. I felt really uncomfortable. I knew zero people who felt that way. And I look online and there's no criticism about the play from that angle. I could find one thing from Laurie Anderson, who says she got up and left, and she called it history light. And I just checked a week ago, and there are a ton of articles now because of the new movie reevaluating Hamilton from this angle.
Yeah.
Probably because of the last year of reevaluating a lot of things. I don't know if you, what,
you know. Well, I mean, first of all, Hamilton is based on a specific book. It's not entirely out of Lin-Manuel's mind. He found a book about Hamilton written by a historian with a particular perspective, and then the play is mostly based on that book. I haven't read that book. I can't really say much about that. But I think that to call it history light is accurate. I think that that is plainly accurate. Does that mean it's worthless? No, I don't think so. I think if you made it more in-depth historically accurate, it would not have been as successful as a musical. There is a line to be, again, I think I said this earlier, a line to be straddled between history, between entertainment and education. It's difficult. It is really hard to straddle that line and really get it right. There was a show a couple years ago of music by Janine Tesori, whom I mentioned, called Soft Power. Soft Power is about the relationship between the United States and China. And Hillary Clinton is a character in it. And it's told from the perspective of a Chinese American man. That show, to me, does a fantastic job of having real political discussion and entertainment in the same show. So it's doable, but it's hard. I think the thing about Hamilton is that what it does with putting actors of color in the place of characters that we think of as white people, there is a philosophical accomplishment there that is a little bit ineffable. Like, you can't quite explain what it, I mean, I'm sure somebody could. I can't quite explain exactly what that is. But I think there's a value there that is independent of how historically accurate the storytelling is. Now, I have criticisms of Hamilton also. And I think that this actually sort of is maybe a criticism of Lin-Manuel Miranda's work in general, that I think he doesn't know too well what to do with women in his stories. And I think you really see that in The Heights. And I think you see it in Hamilton as well. I think probably while they were working on, I may even have read something about this. While they were working on Hamilton, they didn't really have anything of women in it at all. And somebody was like, hey, Lin-Manuel, you might want to address this. And so they wrote this stuff to put women characters closer to center in that show. And I don't think they did that great a job. I think that the parts that are about the women are kind of forgettable and don't really belong in the show. But I understand why they put them there. But that's a criticism of the work. It's not saying like they shouldn't have done it. It was worthless. It's terrible. It's not terrible. It's not worthless. It could be even better. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's true of everybody's work, of everything, right? So, I agree that Hamilton, to some extent, is a little bit Disney-fied, and that is a legitimate criticism. And it's also just not my favorite musical. I'm thrilled that it got other people into musical theater who might not have been otherwise. And I'm also thrilled that it established, not for the first time, it wasn't the first play to do this, but that it established really solidly that hip hop and musical theater can go together well. Mm-hmm. I just kind of wish that it was a little bit more traditional of a musical in terms of, I wish it was a book musical. I wish that you had songs, rapped or otherwise, and then they stop and you have dialogue and then you have another song. I think that having the dialogue portions all be songs gets a little wearing after a while. But you know, maybe there were things that were in their mind, in Lin-Manuel's mind and in the mind of his collaborators, where they were like, no, it has to be that way, because if we don't, then this, and I may just not be thinking about that. So that's that, you know, there's a lot of depth to creating a work of art that until you do it, you have no idea, you know, because as the viewers after the fact, we really only get the surface, except in the absolute pinnacle works. I mean, the greatest works, I think you can see how amazing they are. Sometimes, anyway, but a lot of the time, we don't notice. That's, you know, it's the, again, it's the sausage being made. We just get the flavors, and we don't know what all went, you know, went into making it what it is.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's been really nice to talk with you and hear your ideas and share ideas. Thank you very much.
I had fun myself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you making time, and hopefully someday we can meet in person.
That would be wonderful.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You've been listening to an interview with Daniel Savio, musical director for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. This Sunday, July 18th, the Mime Troupe presents We Keep Us Safe, a discussion on racial equity and police violence, which continues the discussion towards creating new systems of community safety without police. A press release from the troupe warns, a year after the murder of George Floyd, national sentiments around reforming and defunding the police are swinging back to their levels before Black Lives Matter protests swept the nation in summer 2020. The majority of Americans still oppose diverting funding from police departments. Where do we go next? For more information about the current Mime Troupe podcast radio plays, visit sfmt.org.